This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Welcome to Africa News Tonight. Thank you for joining us. I'm Mukbil Yabaro, and here's what's coming up.
These numbers are actually lower than the actual prevalence. Why? Because we know that only a small proportion of victims actually talk about what they've been going through.
On this International Day of the Girl Child, Claudio Capa, UNICEF's top advisor on statistics, says new estimates show 1 in 8 girls and women experience rape or sexual assault in childhood, with most cases occurring in sub-Saharan Africa also. And a high-ranking U.S. senator has criticized the results of Tunisia's presidential election. And a doctor who has made 11 visits to Gaza in the past year tells a haunting story of injured siblings. All this and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. The war in Gaza has claimed more than 42,000 lives since Israel began attacking the Palestinian territory. This was in response to the attack by Hamas militants on October 7th last year, which killed almost 1,200 people and resulted in about 250 individuals being taken hostage. As the toll of deaths and injuries has climbed, doctors from around the world have volunteered to try to ease the suffering in Gaza. Darren Taylor reports.
Italian pediatric surgeon Dr. Federica Lezzi has made 11 visits to Gaza over the past year. In that time, she says, Israeli bombardments have increased, killing mainly women and children.
I worked in the Al-Aqsa Hospital, that is the only hospital remaining in the central Gaza Strip, in the so-called humanitarian zone. That is a little area, like 40 kilometers square.
She remembers two children, a 9-year-old boy, Faris, and his 3-year-old sister, Amira, recently rushed into the hospital emergency room.
Faris start to ask about his sister. She was just next to him, but because of the burn in her face, he didn't even recognize her. She could hear the voice of the brother, but because of the burn in the lungs, she can't talk to him. Burn is like a death sentences in Gaza in this moment, because we don't have water, we don't have antibiotics, we don't have materials to treat burn patient. When Amir arrived in hospital, we all knew that she would die. And for all the day she remained alive, Amira was in pain because we don't have enough painkiller for her.
Letzi says she'll always be haunted by what she's witnessed in Gaza.
After each bombing in Gaza, everybody started to run among the wounded, the dead, the body parts, hoping every time not to find her daughter, her father, her mother. The remains of the bodies end up in a plastic bag. After each bombing, everyone knows also that the remains found don't belong to any person. But a father and a mother know that among the parts, there is their son.
South Africa-based human rights lawyer Attila Kisla is also a regular visitor to Gaza.
Situations like these, like the one in Gaza, show us, of course, the limitations of institutions like the International Court of Justice. Also because the International Court of Justice was designed in that way. So it was designed to operate without enforcement authority. Yet decisions by the International Court of Justice are still important. They inform and influence public opinion, and more importantly, the opinion by the international community, by states.
In January, the ICJ issued a preliminary ruling in a case South Africa filed, ordering Israel to avoid actions that could be genocide in Gaza. The court also ordered the Israeli military to protect civilian lives, an order many in the international community say Israel is defying. Kisla says only one power has the influence to end the tragedy in Gaza, Israel's main ally, the United States, which supplies Israel with military aid. U.S. President Joe Biden has frequently called on Israel to do more to prevent civilian casualties, and his administration has worked to negotiate a ceasefire. The U.S. also has said Israel has the right to defend itself. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
The head of the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Subcommittee on Near East, South Asia, Central Asia, and Counterterrorism has criticized the results of Tunisia's presidential election. Senator Chris Murphy, a Democrat, said President Kais Saied's re-election was predetermined and, in his words, marks the completion of President Saied's plan to restore dictatorship to Tunisia. Tunisia's election commission says Saied won 90% of the vote, but only about 29% of eligible voters cast ballots. Murphy called on the United States to continue its support of Tunisian people, civil society, and independent media. Mongi Daoudi, a Tunisian-American political analyst, discussed this statement with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El Shenawi.
Senator Murphy, being the chairman of subcommittee of the foreign issues in the Senate, and he is very well versed on Tunisia. He follows these issues closely. And his statement, unfortunately, is very accurate. And it is reflective of the broader international concern about Kais Saied's action for the past few years, since 2021 specifically. In particular, if you focus on his statement, you'll see that he kind of highlighted two main points. The first one is how Kais Saied systematically targeted and systematically went about dismantling the Tunisia's democratic constitution, and by highlighting the fact that this is, quote, determined a long time ago, talking about the results of the election. So he did touch on that point, meaning Kais Saied, he prepared for this result of these elections by dismantling so many institutions, dissolving the parliament, changing the whole constitution, putting his hand on the judiciary system and changing the rules of the game. Even 1 week before the election, Kais Saied changed one of the courts that supposedly should play as an arbitrary to some of the complaints because he didn't like some of their rules. So he changed the court. So you have somebody who's changing the rules of the game in the middle of the game. The second point that he highlighted in his statement was the fact that less than 30% of the Tunisians went out to vote. And this is a pattern that we've seen in the past few years where Tunisians did not participate in the online consultation that Kais Saied launched after his coup. The Tunisians did not go and ratify the constitution that he wrote by himself, only like 11% that went out and voted. The Tunisians, the same thing, did not go and vote on the new parliament that he basically installed there so they can rubber stamp some of his laws. So this was a pattern that Tunisians have rejected Kais Saied, rejected his way of ruling by himself, knowing that this man has no solutions for the country's ill, including the economic issues.
Senator Murphy called on the United States to continue its support of the Tunisian people, civil society, and independent media in hopes for a brighter future. Is that enough to revive democracy in Tunisia?
Unfortunately, the simple answer to this question is no, that is not enough. Senator Murphy has called for these measures for quite a while, not just him, but Senator Durbin, other members of Congress in the House, they did the same thing. And unfortunately, the U.S. government has done some of these steps in cutting the foreign aid, reducing the aid, whether it's an economic aid or even the military and security aid was cut, but it was still substantial. But this has resulted to nothing. Kais Saied brushed this off as interference in Tunisian affairs and did not produce anything. So I think the international community, the European Union, the U.S., must come up with a better strategy how to force Kais Saied at least to open up the political and allow at least for some political dissent, allow for civil society to act. Otherwise, we are entering a very dark moment in Tunisian political history.
Despite the criticism of Saied's control of the government, many of his supporters celebrate in the capital after state television broadcast the results. Some of supporters of the president who rode anti-establishment backlash to win a first term 5 years ago said his second win would send a clear message to the political class that preceded his abstinence. Saied has said he dissolved parliament in 2021 and pushed for a passage of a new constitution because politicians had been unable to act to improve the economy or security. The first ever estimates on sexual violence during childhood show an alarming prevalence with devastating consequences on children. On this International Day of the Girl Child, UNICEF estimates more than 370 million girls and women, or 1 in 8, experience rape or sexual assault before the age of 18, and the highest number of sexual assaults occur in sub-Saharan Africa. For more, VOA's Carol Van Dam spoke with Catherine Pulitin, UNICEF Child Protection Manager, and Claudio Capa, UNICEF Senior Advisor on the statistics.
In the case of sub-Saharan Africa specifically, because we are talking about an absolute number, the number is the combination of two factors: the population of this region and the risk of encountering or exposed to sexual violence. So the risk is high in sub-Saharan Africa, but it's also a region where there is a significant population of girls and boys and women and men. So that's the combination of the risk with the size of the population that gives these 79 million children. There are other regions, however, that have a smaller population, but the risk is much higher. So if we look at the prevalence estimate, Oceania, for example, has the highest risk. In that part of the world, 1 out of 3 adult women report experience of sexual assault or rape in childhood. So we need to look at both the absolute numbers as well as the prevalence, give us the risk.
A third of women are being sexually assaulted or raped.
A third of women have reported being raped or sexually assaulted in their childhood before they turned the age of 18. And we might expect that these numbers are actually lower than the actual prevalence. Why? Because we know that only a small proportion of victims actually talk about what they've been going through.
Why is that? Because of the stigma that's attached?
Of course. There are many different reasons. It's only a small proportion, approximately 1% of all victims, who report their experience to an authority. But also we notice, and that's what we publish in the report, is that many victims don't talk about it at all with anybody, not with a friend, not with a family member. Why? There is stigma, of course. There is shame. Sometimes victims, unfortunately, get further victimized because they are not believed or because there is victim shaming going on. But there is also another important consideration, Carol, and it's the fact that many of these perpetrators are actually known by the victim. We are not talking about the rape of a stranger. We are talking about relationship. We are talking about friends and neighbors. We are talking about family members. So reporting and talking about it becomes extremely complex.
Let me bring in Catherine here. Catherine Poulton, you are the UNICEF Child Protection Manager. Why do the perpetrators of sexual violence in sub-Sahara and other places, why do they get away with it?
I think one is often the perpetrator is known, and it's a lot of responsibility to put on a child to report an adult that is known, maybe a parent, maybe a family member, maybe a friend. So there's a lot of fear. Often they've been threatened not to report. I think the other thing is, you know, in many parts of the world, there are no services to report. You know, if you look at many of these areas that we're talking about, including in wealthier countries, we don't have the number of services that are required to support this level of distress. And I think it's really important to notice we need more funding and more resources to respond to this. You know, you can't expect children to know automatically where to go, to feel safe to report it, especially in areas of conflict where we see the numbers are even higher than where there is no conflict.
There's a big spike, according to this data, between the ages of 14 and 17, the ones who are abused. Why are girls of this age targeted? And who are we? You've alluded to it, but who are we talking about? Are there abusers?
Adolescent is a period of vulnerability because of many reasons, right? The first one is this is when girls and boys start having relationship. They might start dating and they might have expanded friendship and relationship more broadly, right? There is transformation of the body. There are expectations about complying with what is expected of them within the context of a relationship, within the context of friendship. There are also a lot of forms of violence that are normalized.
That is Catherine Poulton, UNICEF Child Protection Manager, and Claudia Kappa, UNICEF Senior Advisor on Statistics. Both were speaking to VOA's Carol Van Dam from New York. You're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Find us on voaafrica.com. There you will find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. I'm your host, Mukbil Yabro, here in Washington. We'd love to hear from you. You can share your thoughts about the news in our programs by WhatsApp. The number is +1-202-258-3076. Every Wednesday, we'll be sharing our listeners' comments on Africa News Tonight. There is a significant group of U.S. voters who believe one religion should dictate the nation's laws, but that notion is a divisive issue between liberals and conservatives, Democrats and Republicans. VOA senior Washington correspondent Carolyn Pursuti tells us more about Christian nationalism.
Two rallies, two different views.
Giving Jesus a standing ovation.
This is the Rally for Democracy, supporting all religions.
Now, hands together, everybody.
This one is the Reawaken America Tour.
Jesus is my savior. Donald Trump is my president.
Now in its third year, the tour supports Christian nationalism, the idea that the United States is a Christian country and should have laws reflecting that. Diane Bollinger is buying souvenirs during a break at the rally.
I will gladly be a Christian nationalist, because what can you say against Christianity? And they talked about, I'm following the God of love, following my life after Jesus, and I love my country. MAGA, make America great again. What is wrong with that?
Nothing, says Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump.
Together we're warriors in a righteous crusade to stop the arsonists, the atheists, globalists, and the Marxists, and that's what they are. And we will restore our republic as one nation under God with liberty and justice for all.
Patty Kinsinger is a Pennsylvania voter.
Our country was built on the Christian and Judeo values and principles. That's how they wrote the Constitution.
America's Constitution does not mention Christianity. Instead, it grants freedom of religion. The Declaration of Independence says rights are provided by a creator and mentions, quote, nature's God.
Father, we thank you for pastors of America.
Still, ministers at the Reawaken America tour take an oath to preach voting for godly candidates. Democrats say that's a violation of the constitutional separation between church and state, like Mary Jo O'Rourke, a Democrat from Montana.
The ministers out there really need to look and talk to their congregations about what it means to have liberty and justice for all.
Others at the Rally for Democracy agree, and some call for a debate on the teachings of Jesus, like Reverend Jim Wallace from Georgetown University.
What did he say? What did he do? Because this kind of message that is wants to attack immigrants and will cause most suffering to the poor and vulnerable is literally a movement that is anti-Christ.
Add to that the abortion debate.
And let us all agree, one does not have to abandon their faith or deeply held beliefs to agree the government should not be telling her.
A Pew Research survey found nearly half of all Americans think the Bible should have an influence on U.S. laws. But the same survey found few think Christianity should be named the nation's official religion. Carolyn Pursuti, VOA News.
I have our VOA digital reporter, Mike Hovey, on Africa News Tonight. Thanks for being on the show, Mike.
Appreciate it, man.
Absolutely. So let's jump right into it. The football international break has caused some more controversy. Mm-hmm. Care to elaborate, man?
Yeah, man. There's been a lot of talkings about the international breaks. They are all coinciding with a land a slide of so many other competitions that are going on. So a lot of players, it's taking a toll on their physical bodies, man. We'll quote example, Rodri, right? He recently got injured. Bukayo Saka is another one who recently fell victim to that. There's a lot of other players.
Martin Odegaard.
Like, there's so many names that typically change the trajectory of any football team, mm-hmm. Whose lives have been profusely impacted by the, not just the international breaks, but there's so many competitions that are all linked to this, right? So,
what's with this scheduling, man? From a fan perspective, it's lovely. We're getting football
all year long,
multiple days, but what's your take on it, on the players?
I mean, it takes a toll on any player, right? So if you think of, let's look at a player like Erling Haaland, right, for example. Mm-hmm. He's like the key point number nine for Manchester City, right? They recently sold Julian Alvarez. Mm-hmm. So Haaland is your key point number nine. Without Haaland, you're having to resort to playing the false nine. That means Haaland automatically off bet is probably playing at least 300 games in a year. Which is, imagine the physical toll. And that's just for club. You still have the international breaks.
Right.
Bear in mind, in the past, in the initial break, we had one 3 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. There's another one now. Right. There's going to be another one in the next couple of weeks.
Right.
On top of that, they've got the FIFA Club World Cup. On top of that, you've got the FIFA World Cup coming up. Like, it's just so many tournaments and so many games that are coming back to back to back that it's taking a physical toll on these players.
Absolutely. No, I definitely would agree. Of some of the international games that we did see, though, over this week, mm-hmm. any of them stand out to you?
Yeah, I mean, I'll just jump into it. The British Lions.
Wow.
That one was the biggest upset and surprise that a lot of people caught off guard. They lost to Greece 2-1. I would say that was the standout one. Of course, the one that wasn't shocking for me was France-Israel, 4-1 for France-Israel. But there were also other games, if we're going to bring it back home locally for Africans. We had a lot of Africa Cup of Nations qualifying matches. Mm-hmm. Some big names were not surprising. Some teams stood up tall. So, for example, we're looking at, I'll mention my home country, Zimbabwe. They won. They're topping their group right now. They defeated Namibia 1-0. And then we look at DRC, another big name, beating Tanzania. Mm-hmm. They won 1-0. Botswana won 1-0 against Cape Verde. And then the last game that we'll spotlight is Ghana-Sudan. That ended up with a 0-0 draw. The other games that are going to be played today and tomorrow.
Absolutely. Speaking about Ghana, there is a friendly match that will be happening this weekend, actually. I believe you will be there.
Yes, sir.
At the Audi Field, DC United versus the Ghanaian Premier League champs, Asante Kotoko. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on the game? And what are your thoughts on this kind of like a tradition, right? It's been happening now for a few years where there's a friendly match happening between the Ghanaian Prem leaders versus mm-hmm. the DC United team.
Yeah, so initially the game was scheduled to be played today, tomorrow against Asante Kotoko, but it's not going to be Asante Kotoko now due to visa challenges. Mm-hmm. Some of the players didn't make it. So about 7 or 8 players are from Asante Kotoko are going to be playing in this game. So they've changed it now. So it's Asante Kotoko with another some players from another team, and then members of Ghana's diaspora, that football players that play here in the United States.
Okay.
They're all formulating what they're calling the Ghana Week DC Select Side. So this, as you mentioned, is a traditional game that's played annually. It's part of, like, I guess Ghanaians in the DMV celebrating their culture and figuring out how to link that diaspora angle back to the continent. And so this year, it was supposed to be against Asante Kotoko, but that's not happening. But either way, we're still going to see it, which is, I mean, it's really beautiful for Ghanaian football, right?
Yeah.
You're seeing an opportunity for, A, your players to be able to tap into leagues like the MLS.
Right.
And it's also an opportunity for Ghana just to celebrate its culture, man. There's so many people who are members of the diaspora who are here in Washington, D.C.,
right.
who play football. Some might won't even want to go back home. You never know. You might find another black star out here. So it's going to be interesting. I'm looking forward to seeing this game and, of course, covering it.
Absolutely. So, jollof rice, who has the best jollof?
Yeah.
All right, I got you. But if you had to do a quick prediction, DC United versus this Ghana Week team, who do you got? Or who would you like to see?
It's going
to
be interesting, man. Either way, I think there's no loser out of this. DC United, I hope they win it because, America's taking a different look at football right now. But hey, anyone can take it.
Absolutely. Appreciate it, Mike. Thanks, man. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Mukbil Yabro in Washington for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7. Visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Dave Vandy, and our engineer, Pete Hundley, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.